This is the AI Health Podcast, where we explore the ways in which AI will transform healthcare, biotech, and medicine through conversations with entrepreneurs, investors, and scientists.
Hey, I'm your co-host Pranav Rajpurkar.
And I'm Adrielle Saporta.
And you're listening to the AI Health Podcast. Today, we'll be speaking with Dr. Trishan Punch. Dr. Punch is an instructor at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and co-founder of WellFrame, which provides digital solutions for health management. He holds a master's in public health as well as an MD and practiced medicine for 17 years, during which he led a large risk-bearing primary care group in the UK. Dr. Punch was the inaugural recipient of Harvard's Public Health Innovation Award and is currently on the Innovation Advisory Board of Boston Children's Hospital.
There is quite a bit in that bio to unpack. What will we be focusing on today?
Well, we'll focus quite a bit on Dr. Punch's work with WellFrame. We'll talk about WellFrame's inception approach and business strategy for providing digital and AI solutions for health management. Let's start a bit by talking about what health management even means in the first place. Then he can help us understand how digitization and AI tools can fit in.
Okay. Sounds good. So Dr. Punch mentions the importance of focusing on patients with multimorbidities, so people who have more than one chronic medical condition. But before we even get into multimorbidities, can we focus on what management of just one condition looks like? So say diabetes?
Yeah. In the US, about 37 million people or 11% of the population has diabetes. So quite a few of our listeners are probably very familiar with this. Let's walk through the American Diabetes Association's plan for care and management of type 2 diabetes to get a fairly thorough understanding of just how much organization is required.
That's a great idea. And remind me what diabetes is exactly and the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, so diabetes is when the body's ability to produce or respond to insulin is impaired, which results in elevated levels of glucose in the blood and urine, so high blood sugar. Over time, if it is not managed properly, it can lead to serious conditions like heart disease, vision loss, and kidney disease. Type 1 diabetes is usually diagnosed in children and teens, usually with healthy body weight, and is actually an autoimmune condition. The immune system destroys insulin-producing cells in the pancreas. About 5 to 10% of diabetics have type 1 diabetes, and there's no known prevention. Type 2 diabetes is the more common form of diabetes and most often develops after the age of 45 and occurs when the body stops creating enough insulin or cells develop resistance to insulin. Some risk factors for type 2 diabetes are being overweight and not getting enough physical activity.
Okay, so you said that we're going to talk about type 2 diabetes. And as I understand it, the overriding goals are to manage and monitor blood sugar levels and to pay attention to those serious conditions that type 2 diabetes can lead to, like heart disease and vision loss.
Yes, and this can require quite a team of people, which we'll get into in a bit. The keys to managing type 2 diabetes are a healthy diet and active lifestyle, though most people will need to take one or more medications as well. One of the goals of a diabetes management plan is to set a target blood sugar range to stay within, and since different people are different, this range should be personalized.
So how can you tell whether you're in this target blood sugar range, and what can you do to then get there to that range?
So there are two main kinds of testing. The American Diabetes Association recommends an A1C blood test every 3 to 6 months. This measures the average blood sugar for the last 2 to 3 months, and their target is less than 7% for most people with diabetes.
So I guess checking every 3 to 6 months will give you a decent picture of how your plan is working long-term, but that's still not very frequent, right?
No. So most folks will also use a blood glucose meter to check glucose levels far more frequently, or even a continuous glucose monitor, which tracks levels day and night. The right approach will, of course, depend on the patient. You'll generally have a blood sugar goal for fasting a blood sugar goal for 2 hours after eating, and a blood sugar goal for other times. If you have a continuous glucose monitor, you can track what percent of the day you spend within your glucose target range and then adjust medication, diet, and exercise accordingly.
Got it. And that's just the blood sugar piece, right? There are already a lot of different numbers and factors there to monitor. And so I can only imagine why communication between patient and doctor is really, really key.
Exactly. And one of the foci of our conversations today will be on how digital tools can help tighten that feedback loop. So moving on to some of the other things required to properly manage diabetes, you also need to pay close attention to heart health, since having diabetes increases your risk. You should test cholesterol every year, and your care team will also be responsible for setting goals for good and bad cholesterol and possibly prescribing cholesterol-lowering medication. It's recommended that you set goals for blood pressure as well.
Wow. And any other major areas that you would need to pay particularly close attention to?
Kidney health is super important, since diabetes is the leading cause of chronic kidney disease, and there are a few key yearly tests to test for that. Eye exams, foot exams, and dental checkups are also important.
Okay. So this is very helpful in understanding why sticking to a health management plan can be so difficult. Like, just to manage diabetes alone, it's key to have a team of diabetes management and support, a behavioral health specialist, a medical nutrition therapist, an eye doctor, a foot doctor, cardiologist, etc. And many patients have other conditions at the same time, like heart disease or depression. And so that hugely complicates things and is one of the most important challenges in population health right now.
Totally. I'm really excited to turn the discussion over to Dr. Punch, who will go into a lot more detail on how exactly digital solutions can help here, as well as how to sell them, measure their success, and more. Trishan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Pranav. Thanks, Adriano. Thanks for having me.
I want to start by asking you about an article you wrote in the Harvard Business Review, which is titled How AI Vendors Can Navigate the Healthcare Industry. And I found this fascinating. As I understand it, you studied AI across 15 sets of use cases. You looked at patient engagement, care delivery, population health, R&D administration. I'd love to start by hearing about your experience doing this study.
Sure. I wrote this in partnership with Nikhil Bhojwani. It was the two of us writing, and he's a experienced consultant, business strategist, spends a lot of time working with large healthcare organizations, you know, across the spectrum, life sciences, payer provider, technology, and even startups and that kind of thing. And the two of us were talking about something that we were seeing emerging from his perspective and then from mine in terms of leading WellFrame. And so we were essentially working with healthcare organizations and trying to see how these kind of techniques can apply. And I think one thing that both of us realized, and we also realized was not necessarily in the kind of common understanding, certainly on the business side, I think on the technical side, it was much better understood, is that these techniques are much less scalable than, I guess, what let's call it classical software solutions, you know, pre-written code that has a kind of deterministic purpose within healthcare. And that, I think on the business side of things, we felt just really was not well understood. That you could train a model on something and then scale that model at basically zero marginal cost for every instance of the problem from there on in. And many of your listeners, certainly everyone reading your newsletter, would appreciate that's kind of absurd. But that is actually a fairly mainstream view in some of the business literature, let's put it that way. And so that was really the kind of purpose of writing the article. I think just in terms of broader context, if it's helpful to your listeners in terms of why we were kind of writing that, why I'm saying these things. So I'm a primary care physician, and then I trained in public health. You know, so my kind of interest, I suppose, is trying to get what works. And historically, for most of my career, that's been preventive medicine, primary prevention, secondary prevention, to large populations, to as many people as possible. And most of the tools historic for the first kind of decade of my career that I had to do that were seeing patients myself and organizing the activities of other people who see patients. And the way we could do that is by hiring and training and creating a culture, but then also creating like specific clinical protocols, rules or processes for like, you know, how you provide care to thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people with many of these complex conditions at at any one time. Now, my kind of light bulb moment, but I guess why I went in this direction rather than carried on doing that, was that, you know, we realized back in the early days of mobile, it was in 2009 when I did the MPH here at HSBH, there was just clearly an opportunity for much greater reach if we could take those protocols that I was developing to train clinicians and represent them programmatically or algorithmically, whichever way you want to put it, essentially kind of instance them in code, and also make them interoperable. So you could have, for patients that have five or six conditions, you could have different protocols, and we have some rules that determine which ones can be used together, which ones can't. And I started working on that. That became WellFrame to kind of accelerate through a decade. We work with health plans and risk-bearing providers, anyone who's holding the financial risk for the outcomes of populations. And a lot of those risks are concentrated in people with multiple concurrent chronic conditions, which in medicine, we now have a term for that, which is actually only a few years old itself, which is called multimorbidity, multiple concurrent chronic conditions. And obviously, most of the risk in health systems is concentrated in these people. And at WellFrame, we built a digital health solution that can apply to any patient based on their condition or combination of conditions. And the reason that we did that, and I guess the intersection between that and the machine learning work, is that when we first started doing it, we were really initially kind of researchers starting looking at this problem, asking the what if question, would it be possible to do something like this? And we realized that, well, if we could instrument chronic disease management, the delivery of longitudinal primary care for large populations, and we could develop that data set, and we had some sense of the intermediate health states that a person goes through in between, say, discharge and a readmission, then we might have a fighting chance of using some of these techniques that in that case were emergent. I mean, in 2010, when we started doing this, obviously neural nets existed. They weren't particularly great. You know, deep learning really started taking hold. I was involved in the early group that developed Mimic at MIT, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners know. And we were kind of interested, well, if we could instrument chronic disease management like we'd instrumented the ICU in the Mimic dataset, then maybe we could use some of the same techniques to develop. And I guess you could articulate in so many different ways.
Tertian, actually, can you just quickly explain what you mean by instrumenting?
Sure. Essentially, if you look at medicine, and if you're in the hospital, let's just say you're in the ICU, most of us would be unconscious in that situation. And you have things monitoring all sorts of elements of your physiology. The abstraction that is medicine is that the body is made up of lots of discrete systems that also interact. And you can measure the performance of each one of those systems by either directly measuring it with like electrodes or something like that, or you can measure it by measuring the presence of chemicals or pressure or waveforms in the body. So in that situation, someone is instrumented. Now, of course, once you leave hospital and go home, there's basically nothing. So you're then in the situation whereby, for the clinician at least, we know a lot about you whilst you're in hospital. We know almost nothing about you whilst you're at home. And then when you come back, say to an office visit, see someone like myself, then what we're spending at least 50% of the consultation just trying to figure out what was going on with you in between when you left us last time and when you came back. And the tools we have to do that is basically asking you to tell a story, and our ability to understand that story and to create some hypotheses from that, and then to drill down into those with like very kind of specific things, maybe examination or tests therein. And that's kind of inefficient to say, and it's even more inefficient to do. So we were just interested, would it be possible to, you know, just get more data on that area by actually providing people, patients with value in terms of what they need to do and connecting them in a therapeutic relationship.
And can you talk about the patient journey through WellFrame here? Like, when someone used WellFrame, what would this new world look like?
Yeah, so I can actually do that kind of like very concretely. Back in 2012, when we started, we worked with an academic medical center in the Longwood medical area, let's put it that way, and another in more suburban Massachusetts. And we worked with their cardiac rehab clinics. And we actually published some studies. So someone has a heart attack, very common problem, of course. They have a procedure, typically a stent. They go home. After that, all insurers pay for, and all patients are kind of compelled to do, it's part of the standard discharge procedure, something called cardiac rehab. And cardiac rehab is essentially a structured program of what's called secondary prevention. So doing stuff to prevent you having a recurrence of a condition that you've already got, or a worsening of a condition you've already got. And that infrastructure is paid for by all payers. It's present on the standard discharge sets of all clinical organizations, but unfortunately only 20% of patients who are eligible, which is basically everyone who has heart attack, go. There's a ton of different reasons for it, but basically it's like to do with convenience, and it's to do with the fact that the patient is doing a lot of the work of cardiac rehab by themselves at home rather than in the clinic. And of course they need to do it for the rest of their lives. And turning up to a gym in a hospital for like half an hour, paying for parking, walking on a treadmill with like a EKG machine, just for most people, you know, even for the people who are very anxious, they realize after a bit that maybe they can do this by themselves and they don't need it. But of course, the problem is they've got to do a load of different things every day. There's actually like six or seven modalities of care that is typical for any chronic condition. And they get confused or something else comes up, just like any of us have tried weight loss or fitness, right? There's just, you've got to coordinate a number of things. Sometimes life just gets in the way, you know, and so you get confused and give up. And WellFrame was basically designed to solve that problem. And we always felt what was much more interesting is the general form of that problem. So rather than just how does that look for cardiac rehab, we then did it for people with severe and persistent mental illness with McLean, and we published a paper there as well. So that's totally different. That's psychiatric rehabilitation for people who've had a severe and persistent mental illness. Actually, most of the patients had schizophrenia or bipolar affective disorder. So very severe hospitalizable conditions. But again, it's the same thing. They need to do things to recover. And so we built a platform to help them do that. And our expectation was that we would collect data on people doing that. And then we could use, like, we didn't really think about it explicitly at the time, but like we could use machine learning techniques to figure out for that population, given the digital health data, what are the predictors of these endpoints, such as like readmission or needing input from a clinician.
I was going to note, you mentioned it, two places you published papers. And of course, you know, you're an academic. And so publishing papers is one way in which you can establish credibility behind the technology itself. But I'm curious, is there a interplay there in terms of publishing a paper and improving your ability to sell a product?
I think what unites them both is that this is, from the public health point of view, why public health has something to offer in terms of digital health or healthcare entrepreneurship, is that really what we're trying to focus on is, you know, have we figured out the root cause of the problem? And is this solution, does it actually work and is it scalable? And really what we're saying there is there like some kind of signal, and is that signal generalizable? And of course, if you are in business, you are trying to figure out the answer to that question as well, because if you figure that out, then of course your product has a much larger total addressable market than, you know, if it just works for, I don't know, left-handed window cleaners, say. Similarly, from the kind of research point of view, those are the interesting questions, right? So I think there is a kind of natural connection. I think, unfortunately, the incentives are very different for researchers and entrepreneurs, I have found, in terms of dabbling in in both camps. I guess, you know, one of the things that I see is just a classic kind of trope from the researcher side is, well, you know, like, here's the solution, here's what I believe the end state should be, but it's up to others to kind of build something that gets there. Building something that gets there involves, I would argue, two different kinds of engineering. One is typically in these areas, you have to build a product that is super fun. And I would encourage anyone who has any interest in doing that to do it. But the second form of engineering is not typically in the academic skill set. Unfortunately, for many clinicians, it's not typically in the clinical skill set. I would argue for many machine learning researchers, it's not in their skill set either, which is basically re-engineering these incentive networks, which involves figuring out what the incentive network is in the first place. You know, like, why do people do stuff? And particularly within organizations, why do people do stuff? And therefore figuring out how they could do it differently in a way that advances the implementation of your product. So the kind of incentive engineering piece, understanding how organizations work in the real world, how they can work differently, and then crucially doing the, and there's so many different analogies people use, block and tackle, trench warfare, whatever you want to call it. The kind of very conceptually less interesting work to do that is typically not there in the academic skill set. Now, I'm not saying that applies to everyone, of course, but that, I think the trope on that side, and I think the trope on the entrepreneur side or the business side is, and I think it's totally fair, is that you're just essentially overgeneralizing. And I think we can take machine learning going right back to the top as a classic example here, is that like, well, yeah, people are just saying that like these solutions, you train them once on some data somewhere, and like that then is like this AI that will do artificial intelligence things and will, like, you know, I don't know, offer superhuman performance for all kinds of patients. And that is not particularly helpful. And That's why we wrote the paper, basically, that we realized that like this is not nowhere near as generalizable as possible. And what you're seeing is the different incentives and different tropes of the different groups. You know, and I think with these things, it's important not to be like, well, this none of this is going to work and it's all a waste of time. And, you know, it's all just like wasted money and this and that, whatever. Like there has to be something practical and something hopeful. So we were just trying to reconcile. So in the paper, we're trying to reconcile it and say that, well, these are the things that you should think about if you're going to be realistic about actually implementing these solutions in healthcare.
Going back to WellFrame for a second. So again, you've got a bunch of patients who should probably go through secondary prevention sort of protocols. It should be covered by insurance companies,
yeah,
but they're not really going through it.
Yeah.
You guys recognize that this is a problem. And so you want to try to incentivize patients to actually do this.
Yeah.
And so you want to build this model. And so what's the prediction task that you guys are tackling?
Sure. So actually, yeah. So if I step back a little bit, Adriel, so just going back to the incentive engineering piece of this, right? So that's exactly the setup. What we realized was there was never really a scalable form of doing this working with providers, with hospitals alone. And so we would have to work with those organizations that were holding the financial risk for patients over time. And so like that set of things that we did with hospitals and we did with studies, we realized through essentially trial and error rather than kind of, you know, we didn't have kind of eureka moment or anything, that we would have to work with health plans. And so,
yeah.
So the setup there, actually, it's really actually pretty simple, but it's kind of somewhat hidden in the health system, actually. So, you know, if you look at, you know, I don't know, 80-20 or whatever it is, you know, most people understand that it's like some small proportion of the patients are driving a disproportionate amount of the cost.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think now if we take the relative societal awakening to structural determinants or structural violence in healthcare, people appreciate that those are people who are also marginalized in society as well. So a small proportion of people, maybe 10% of people in a million person population that will be typical of a commercial health plan in the US are driving, say, 40% of the cost. And those people tend to be older, they tend to be poorer, minority groups are overrepresented there in those groups as well. And for those people, health plans have realized that, well, yeah, what we should do is get everyone to be healthier. And then that shifts the mean, right?
Right.
And therefore, like the area under the curve or the absolute number of people who you're helping is greater. But of course, that takes a huge amount of time to do. It involves lots of shifts in society that are beyond what clinical organizations can do, however big they are. So what we do in medicine is we say, well, yeah, we should definitely do that. But we should also like try and do an approach of targeting those people who have the need now and trying to help them and shift like that element of the curve along. So health plans have something called care management, which is basically trying to do that. And what it recognizes is that there's a minority of people who are driving a disproportionate amount of costs. And those are people who are also most vulnerable in society. And the reason that they're having these costs is because they have multiple concurrent chronic conditions, as we discussed previously, this concept of multimorbidity. And they need to do stuff to manage those conditions in between visits after discharge, i.e. they're doing most of that work entirely by themselves. And one of the papers we cited had looked at from a time and motion point of view, managing chronic conditions. And they found that basically patients have to do roughly 30 minutes of work every single day if they have more than one concurrent chronic condition. And they're doing most of that work by themselves. So that's what, like 180 hours a year, if you want to put it that way. If you look at like the amount of consultation time for a patient with two or more chronic conditions, it's typically less than an hour. It obviously goes up. We're talking about like just about managing those conditions rather than like they break their leg or something like that. But there's obviously a massive disparity there. There is a 90-fold disparity. Health plans recognize that these people are driving a lot of the preventable burden of disease, that that's very costly, that that's because of they're doing most of the work themselves. And if they have four conditions, they have four different clinicians, eight different meds, 12 different hospital appointments. It's just overwhelming to figure out. So why don't we help them do that? Before software, particularly on mobile, the way of them helping do that was, why don't we phone you up every 6 months? Which basically doesn't really work that well, as you might imagine, right? In spite of the best intention. So what WellFrame does is shifting that workflow over to an asynchronous digital workflow, equivalent of flipping the classroom. So the patient gets all the things they need to do and look out for through a mobile application on their cell phone or tablet, iOS or Android, tells them what they need to do, what they need to look out for, captures all that information, shares it with a clinician. And then what we're doing is like trying to figure out it, to start off with in a very simple rules-based way. these are the people as a clinician that are fine by themselves. These are the people that need input now. These are the people that need a referral. These are the people that need escalation into whatever. And we started off doing that. I really wanted to do that at the beginning with machine learning. It's kind of an obvious supervised learning problem. There was two problems with that. One is we didn't have the data. We didn't have anywhere near enough data given the size of the space. But secondly, and I think this is more of a general insight, clinical organizations aren't really comfortable with that. Well, they certainly weren't in 2012 when we started doing it.
And ultimately, clinicians were your customer, your audience.
Yeah, exactly. Or at least there was a clinician user to the product, and there still is.
Right.
But equally, there was a clinician buyer, and it was the people who were managing kind of the CMO of managing kind of clinical risk. And I think that's generally present, you know, with the kind of solutions that you guys cover so well in the newsletter, in Dr. Penguin, you know, like that will end up going to a clinical leader who is going to vet the solution and figure out, is this something that can apply safely in my population? And even now in 2022, probabilistic diagnostic solutions are tricky for clinical knowledge to get their head around. So that's why we started off doing that with a rules-based system. And our plan was, well, okay, let's get that to some scale, collect the data, and then we can kind of reassess that.
And this rules-based system was just applied on a patient-by-patient basis.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. I mean, so the way the WellFrame system works is like, let me just explain it from like an individual patient's point of view. So let's just take someone in a post-discharge program. It's easiest to explain. So someone is discharged from hospital, they go home, someone from the health plan would phone them up and say, oh, you've been to hospital. This is kind of fairly standard stuff. You've been to hospital, you've had these things. Do you have a post-discharge appointment booked? And sometimes it's someone on the hospital side who does this. It kind of depends where the risk bearing is. What healthcare is obviously confusing because it kind of depends how they've done the contracting behind the scenes, which as a patient, you'll obviously never see. So sometimes the hospital does it, sometimes the health plan does it. Phone you up, just make sure you've got all the things you need to do after going home to make sure that, like, you know, your plan of care is put into effect. Having a primary care physician, having a visit booked for the primary care physician, having your meds, being okay in your like home environment, things that you would think are somewhat basic, I suppose, but they're things that have a massive influence on whether someone gets readmitted. So that person goes home, but rather than that phone call, they get that phone call and they get, well, invited onto using WellFrame. And actually that gets more automated with text messages, and we do email campaigns before and all that stuff as well. But they then download the application with their member ID. They're then matched to a care plan that's personalized for them, given their combination of conditions. Every single day gives them a checklist, a multimedia checklist of all the things they need to do and look out for them, given their combination of conditions on that day. They then do those things or not. And that data is collected, and then we compute kind of what needs to be done based on some simple, to start off with, if-then logic, you know, and it's kind of fairly obvious stuff. I mean, it can be as like granular as someone who said, well, I want to quit smoking, or I'm ready to quit smoking, and then they get connected to a smoking cessation therapist or something like that. And it can be much more complicated. And then we also have a chat channel in parallel to that where the, and this is where the utility comes from the patient point of view, because just completing checklists, no patient is ever going to do for more than maybe 1 or 2 days, right? And certainly not for the kind of engagement numbers that we needed to make WellFrame work and to kind of solve this problem. So what we have is that you do that stuff and a clinician, a real person, chats to you and says, oh, well done, you've done this stuff. I've noticed you're doing this. Like, if there's anything I can do, I'm such and such, like, just drop me a line here. And so that goes from, you've got a real person who, you know, is from your local community typically, and, you know, is there to kind of help you out and is available in your pocket through the software thing. And then the first place that we actually started applying machine learning stuff is in looking at essentially named entity recognition on stuff that was being mentioned in chat. We found that actually an incredibly strong signal. It was interesting because we had this data set that was, I don't know how unique it is now, but certainly when we started, we're like, well, we've got a massive data set of patient-generated language about managing chronic conditions over time in patient-generated language. And we found actually that a lot of the kind of off-the-shelf techniques don't work that well there because they're trained on a very different corpus. So we used, I mean, pretty established stuff now, I suppose. And it was, you know, like we used it to train on the WellFrame, to retrain more specifically on the WellFrame data set. And we built classifiers for specific terms that we got consensus with the clinicians were important. Yeah, actually, maybe I can go into that. It's actually a very COVID relevant thing, is that.
That'd be great.
Yeah, so we work with a lot of Medicaid plans. So you know, it's the public insurance for people who are low income. And we work in a number of states. We actually work with the largest national provider of these Medicaid plans. So in the early days of COVID, so back in like March 2020, what we were able to do with that is basically, you know, kind of look at who is mentioning COVID or COVID flu-like symptoms in like who was bringing that up in the chat. And obviously this is over large, I think with that, it was like maybe 150,000 people, something like that, patients who are being managed. So if they were doing all of that through phone calls, which was the standard of care otherwise, obviously no one knows, unless clinicians kind of somehow figure it out, whatever. But we were able to show that, okay, people weren't really talking about this at all until like February or so, certainly in the states we were working in. We were looking at Texas and Florida and one other. But then as like the, you know, you saw spikes after things were in the news, we saw there was kind of greater familiarity. You essentially went from zero through to like much higher than any seasonal mention of flu-like things. But what was really interesting is that we then started looking for, and this is kind of stuff that came from the literature as well, that we started looking for, you know, other kind of social issues. So domestic violence, housing insecurity, concern about income and all that stuff. And then we were able to spin up a set of terms related to that. And then we were able to surface, firstly, in reports to the people who are managing these clinicians.
What do you do with that information? So you surface it to the health plan, but then what does the health plan do with domestic violence reports, right?
It's a great point. So the first thing is like bringing awareness that, like, this is a problem. This is a problem that you need to do something about. And of course, yeah, that would be totally irrelevant if the health plan didn't actually kind of care about doing something as well. But the very interesting thing is if you look at Medicaid plans, they do appreciate that these are very kind of vulnerable populations and they have these kind of issues going on. And part of the specific remit is that they have care teams that have social workers, they have connection to housing resources. Now, of course, these aren't in any way perfect solutions, but they do have those resources available. But it's the classic problem in healthcare is that we assume that every patient is the average patient, because until they come and see us, we've got no idea what their needs are, right? So there's basically a kind of supply demand mismatch, if you will. There's people who need access to these like specialist resources to help with like emergent social issues. And there's people who want to help with those things, but they just aren't connected to each other. So really all we're doing is, I mean, I guess in a way, if you want to be super crude about it, it's not that different to Uber, right? It's people who want a ride and people want to give a ride and we're matching them. And it's the same thing as people who want this help, who are mentioning it in chat, just general chat and talking to clinicians. We're recognizing that. And then we're using that to basically connect them to a clinician. But then also what we can do is bring in decision support for those individual clinicians to essentially tag the patient with this information. Because if someone's mentioned this 3 months ago, it may well be germane to them complaining of headaches or not feeling good or not able to go to their appointments 3 months later. But of course, in the stream of consciousness of all the things that people are talking about in their daily interactions, that's lost. So we're able to kind of bring that back, if you will. And basically, so the clinician is aware of this previous context. That's actually super helpful because often, unfortunately, as clinicians, you just forget because you're seeing so many people over such a large amount of time. And then the second thing is we can just directly tell them, like, if then, and that's totally rules-based. So we use the machine learning to, like, you know, essentially kind of figure out the topics that are relevant to this individual patient. And then we basically say, for these things, we're going to tell you to do this other thing. And we get the clinical leaders to approve that. Then there's a bunch of other stuff that is a little bit more experimental that I've been working on with respect to doing that across languages. We've been doing a bunch of R&D stuff with Google, which has been great through GCP to use essentially the cloud translation API to be able to have clinicians and patients talking in different languages and us using the translate API in the back end. But that's not yet in production because it's just, there's a little bit more kind of process to go through there.
I'd love to switch gears a little bit and talk about one of the terms you mentioned that I found very interesting, which was incentive engineering.
Yeah, please.
So to go back a little bit to this, how AI vendors can navigate the healthcare industry, let's hypothetically assume I am a provider and I have several AI vendors that are offering me solutions. How should we re-engineer the incentive system for me?
Yeah, okay. So Pranav, just a little kind of academic plug here. So we do a course at Harvard School of Public Health, Applied AI in Healthcare, which I'm hoping I can rope you into at some point in the future as well, but that's a separate discussion. But really what we're doing there is trying to train the people who are the hypothetical clinician like you in how should they think about this? What's real? What is false promise? what should they do themselves? What should they partner on and do, right? And I think that's the set of questions that these organizations are trying to figure out. And I think for many, the term AI is a box inside of which is just essentially word salad, just a number of different terms without any real connections to each other. And I think that's a big problem. So it's very difficult to answer that. I mean, I can come up with an answer to that question, but the practical answer to it is that we need to get those people who are running healthcare organizations who typically do not have a statistical or a computer science background, the kind of basic primitives of what is machine learning, therefore what is kind of functionally speaking AI in the common parlance. If you don't understand that, it's very difficult to actually meaningfully answer that question for yourself. So I think it's essentially the question you're asking is a strategic question, is that like, what is the problem that we as an organization are trying to solve? Why are we uniquely like suited to solving it? There's information processing tasks, and some of those tasks are inference tasks. Some of those are tractable by insert any one of the kind of prevalent techniques that are more or less established than others. And then we need to have an inventory of like those strategic problems we're trying to solve, the ones that are information tasks, the ones that are inference tasks, the ones that are tractable by AI. Then we make a decision about, should we do that in partnership? Should we build a team ourselves? If so, who do we need to have working here on this? I mean, there's no organization that's going to do everything in-house. I mean, maybe if you're like, one of a handful of technology companies, you would. But even then, they're going to have partnerships with clinical organizations, actually. So like, there's always going to be a partnership model. So I would say that the way of answering that question is there is a good degree of education that's needed that I believe is a bit too much realistically for people who are in full-time jobs and don't have a background or a kind of, you know, an established personal interest in this area, or the luxury of being kind of researchers or academics like us. So we're naturally kind of inquisitive about this to figure out. So, I mean, this is where the incentive engineering thing is, right? Like that organization, what is the problem it's trying to solve? Like, how is it uniquely suited to solve that? What things are core to solving that? What things can accelerate progress, but aren't necessarily core and should be done with partnership? I would argue that for a lot of healthcare organizations, they should rely more on partnership, at least to get things moving. But then it's like on the partner side, on the vendor side, if you want to put it that way, those vendors need to be cognizant of how healthcare organizations work. And on the health organization side, they need to be sure that the problem they're solving is a problem that requires solving and that this solution is going to be scalable once built.
There are a lot of structural barriers to adoption of new technology in healthcare. And one of the challenges AI vendors face is sort of breaking in here. What's your sense on whether the approach of piggybacking on these structures versus sidestepping them is the path forward for us?
Yeah. So I think really fundamentally for most mere mortals, i.e. for everyone other than mega cap tech organizations, it's going to be piggybacking on current structures. So i.e. if you're working on the provider side, working within an existing reimbursement code, or if you're able and some of the vendors of like image recognition diagnostics are working on their own reimbursement codes, making submissions to the FDA, those kind of things. Like that's working within the existing incentive structure, the existing processes. The FDA and other related organizations in other countries are doing a good job of clarifying that process for this new class of vendors. I think even within those solutions are probably less scalable, i.e. they have more variable costs in terms of retraining for all of the kind of common known problems at scale than more of the old school, worst performing rules-based systems. And then there are like, what we argue in the paper is that the sidestepping comes from, well, okay, you can go direct to consumer and maybe establishing presence direct to consumer gets you an ability to kind of go to healthcare organizations and say, well, lots of people are using this already. How about we work together? But you have to be very, very well capitalized to do that. You have to have a strong consumer brand already. And I think, I guess, you know, your audience can tell by inference that really applies to a very small number of organizations. I think we would feel that there's a third way, which is going to organizations that are bearing risk. So this would be health plans typically, or lots of people are looking at life sciences, looking at organizations for whom this helps with internal productivity, i.e. they're not necessarily bound by a codified incentive network of like CPT codes, et cetera, but they're rather using these technologies for their own reducing costs or increasing revenue internally.
One of the stakeholders that I'm curious to ask you about is regulators.
Yes.
So one of the things you talk about in your article is investing and staying ahead of regulatory and public expectations for ethical behavior. Could you talk about how we might expect this to evolve in the future?
Yes, thanks, Pranav. So that's very topical. So with a number of my academic collaborators, we've actually have a paper under review on this subject. And I think the basic premise of that is that regulators have done a lot to try and clarify the rules of the game for doing AI in healthcare, let's put it that way. Certainly for diagnostics, for decision support, for software as a medical device, and how AI would be thought of through that paradigm. And I think that stuff is great. There's still a bunch of like, well, you know, these are things that we're looking at, all these other things you guys need to like figure out yourselves, and here's some principles. But from the regulator's point of view, there's a strong signal coming through that even from the OECD countries, let's just say the kind of the largest, most well-capitalized health systems who think about health technology in a structured way, they really only have the capacity to look at the absolute maximum 100 different technologies every year and to do an evaluation. So, you know, roughly 2 a week, which obviously is a lot considering the amount of intellectual capital that's required to do this. They have to do like a science evaluation, they have to do equity evaluation, they have to do an evaluation of the economic impact of this and whether it's, you know, a reasonable amount of value for the amount paid. These are like complex things to do, and actually it's pretty remarkable that you can do two of those a week actually. But if you look at machine learning, if you look at just like supervised learning for the multiple different applications that you guys cover so well in terms of diagnostic applications of machine learning, there is no way that they have enough capacity to regulate all of those things. And so if there's going to be a regulation pathway to get to scale, it's only going to be possible for a handful of those things. So therefore, there's going to be some criteria for picking which things need to be regulated, what we call centrally. And there's going to need to be mechanisms for decentralized or distributed regulation of clinical AI. And in this paper, we basically specify what those criteria are, and it, you know, it's kind of intuitive stuff around the level of risk and the scale at which this is going to be implemented, i.e. like something is going to be implemented in a national screening program probably should be nationally regulated, right? That's kind of intuitive, and especially if it's a national screening program for something whereby if you miss a case then someone gets cancer fairly quickly and that could be fatal, like things that are of that shape should be nationally regulated. But the vast majority of things are not like that, and for them we propose that there needs to be, you know, this is kind of big stuff, is a little bit provocative, I imagine, for some, a specialty of clinical AI, a process that is an expansion of the IRB for looking at the local implementation of models, performance management, looking at issues like data drift, and on a local level, that would need to be multidisciplinary. It would need to be in some way sort of connected with existing structures, which are IRB, but then also there's structures for looking at quality improvement. Is a product, you know, the product lens that we've discussed here, is that really the right lens for looking at machine learning in healthcare? Is it more, this is just codified clinical knowledge? Like guidelines aren't regulated by the FDA, of course. That's in the area of like, that's medical practice and the professional societies. You know, many people have proposed that that's more of the idiom, more of the way of thinking through this. And we discussed that in the paper. So I think in order to really get this stuff to scale, there's going to have to be some fundamental rethinking about what stuff looks more like a product that's applying at national scale, where you train it, it's locked, it goes out to a large population, there's like regular review of outcomes, you know, fits more of the medical device, drug paradigm, existing infrastructure works. What kind of stuff looks more like an amplification, how would you put it, like kind of weapons grade clinical practice or something like that. And that needs some structures for like local regulation and formulating and being responsible for local best practice that at the moment just doesn't exist, and it's going to need to exist, but there isn't really, we can see at least, a roadmap or someone proposing anything like that. So we had a go, which is what we do. So for those interested, that is hopefully coming in the next couple of months, and then that'll be out hopefully in a PLOS Digital Health if anyone's interested.
Tristan, this has been so wonderful.
Yeah, thanks for your time.
And that's all, folks. A big thank you to Dr. Punch for being with us today, and thank you for listening. We're your hosts, Pranav and Adriel, and until next time, stay safe and stay healthy.
The AI Health Podcast is produced and edited by Oishi Banerjee and Mark Robbins. Music by Ethan A.G. If you like what you just heard, let a friend know. Subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Spotify or connect with us on Twitter at AI Health Podcast.